Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris. And this week, I'm looking for the best book about global pandemics. Yay! Hey, everybody. Yay. Happy 1 year anniversary of the global pandemic that's been happening.
Happy anniversary, guys. It's
happy anniversary.
It's nice. Did it's you nice guys to
get,
still
get
be
the
here.
Global pandemic anything for the anniversary? Or did you forget?
No, but I bought you guys roses.
This is a little gauche, Nick. I don't think roses is actually like the 1 year global pandemic gift. I believe you instead are supposed to give a
mask. Are you looking it up? A vaccine.
It turns out it's wood. You're supposed to give it wood.
I look forward to giving you guys wood on this episode.
Joe, yep. I hold you personally liable for that.
You should play Settlers of Catan with Nick sometime, Ian, if you haven't. It's just wood joke after wood joke after wood joke.
Does he ever do anything like, you've been stoned?
No. Well, don't tell him. Don't tell him. Nick, we should probably start.
To help me.
much like the global pandemic, this episode is going to seem like it takes forever and not make any progress.
Yeah.
We might not even get to a book.
It's also going to feel repetitive because we'll probably make it drag. Anyway, to help me are two high school English teachers, of course. Who more qualified to educate us on good books?
I think an epidemiologist might be good this week.
Bless you. Ian and Joe.
Hi, guys.
Well, that's...
Wow, this is rough.
Joe's transformation into checked out teacher is finally complete. This is his final form.
I am a high school English teacher, and Nick and Ian, if you want a book about a global pandemic, I've got a pretty good one this week. It's by Emily St. John Mandel. It's written in 2015. It's incredibly prescient, and it is called Station 11. It's very hopeful.
Hello, and welcome to...
Hello.
You Don't Know Lit, starring...
Already welcomed, everybody.
No, I'm giving a supplementary welcome. This is my...
Repetitive
this is, listen,
already.
I contribute so little to this show. This is my contribution. It's a supplementary welcome, and I want to specifically welcome you two today to You Don't Know Lit, the podcast we are both doing, all three of us are doing. Mm-hmm. My name, if you haven't noticed, is Dr. Ian DeYoung, Doctor of Hobbitry. Mm-hmm. I'll stick to that. If you want a book about a global pandemic and its aftermath and hope, I don't have a book about hope, but I do have a book about reconstruction. My book is called Zone One. It has zombies, and it is by Colson Whitehead, who is, I think we can say, an honorary godfather of the show by this point. He's appeared
twice. I think
that's
fair to say, yeah.
We think he's great.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Guys, hey, co-hosts, co-pods, pod friends. Let me ask you a question.
Co-pods is fine.
How you been doing in this global pandemic?
Oh, God.
How you doing? How's it going?
Are you okay? Are you okay? Do you need to talk?
I had the realization today that, you know, maybe things start to be normal in like a couple months. And I had the realization today that I've squandered this opportunity completely. It's been a year. I haven't really taken any time off to relax. I didn't sit home and play video games on the couch as much as I would have liked. I've basically wasted this time entirely. What about you guys?
I love the idea of wasting your time is I didn't play video games. I didn't sit on the couch to relax. I just made a podcast and bought a house and had a kid and like, you know, stupid stuff like that.
We do have show rules. Which we'll go over in a moment, but it's important that I want to underscore the premise of this episode and this theme is that your pandemics are worse than the current pandemics because we can't talk about pandemics that are on par with what we're doing. We need to elevate it and by comparison, make us all feel a little bit better.
So to be clear, Nick, the goal of this episode is to say, eh, coronavirus isn't that bad. That's what we're going for?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Can you imagine zombie coronavirus?
Oh.
Now you're starting to feel a little bit more thankful, aren't you? Oh, well, at least it's not zombie.
Yeah, I'm not going to say coronavirus isn't bad, though. I might just say it could be worse.
Yeah. Well, it's about being grateful.
But that still sounds bad. There are people who have lost everything because of COVID. And I feel weird saying to them, hey, well, yeah, but at least there aren't fast zombies.
I'm going to draw a line in the sand right here, Ian. I, for one, am happy that there are not coronavirus zombies walking around biting people. Right. I'll say it here. Right. It is better than what we have.
I reject, Ian, your attempt to turn this into a real serious thing.
Nope.
And I am going to stick with the humor aspect of it and just stick with those pandemic zombies that I don't want those.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and just kind of draw a different line of the sand and say, I don't think any lithead is here because we're funny. They're here because of us being downers.
So in addition to that rule of really selling that your books are terrible, we have three additional rules. Rule number one, only unavoidable spoilers, Ian. Rule number two, a many needless words. And rule number three, winning isn't everything. It's the only thing, Vince Lombardi.
I feel like the litheads listening are going to think that we recorded this at the end of a slumber party. It's 3:30 in the morning. We're all a little punch drunk.
Oh, gracious.
So I think the rules are clear. I would like to hear from Joseph about what your book is about in 30 seconds or less. And then I would like to hear from Ian in a similar fashion, and then I will decide who should go first. Does that sound fair to you guys?
Nick, that sounds fair to me, and I will be ready.
Actually,
it's my turn.
Just in line with the theme, instead of 30 seconds, take 1 year.
Oh, fantastic. In that case, let me tell you guys some stories about the farm. Nick, do you know... Nick, do you know how post-pandemic things and post-apocalyptic things are always really grim, gritty, and they show off the worst of humanity? Yeah, that's it.
Oh, isn't this bad?
Yeah, they show how deep down we're just awful and selfish.
Isn't this what you want? That's why you're reading this book, you sick bastard.
Well, Nick, Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, about 300 pages, and recommended by loyal lithead Olivia and read by me. Oh, no! I'm sorry, Olivia.
It sounds good.
Joe, Ian, your problem is you always try and get audience interaction, and it always cuts into
your head. Yeah, I suck up that clock, Joe.
I do feel like Nick's time shouldn't count against mine.
Yeah.
Olivia, I'm so sorry. Loyal lithead Olivia.
Ian, your time has started.
In a world where a global pandemic has ravaged society, civilians are the only ones who can retake New York City. Zone 1, a zombie novel by returning champion Colson Whitehead, narrates 3 days of this cleanup process, asking challenging questions about humanity, hope, and reconstruction along the way. Published in 2011, running to 259 pages, Zone 1 offers an answer to the question, when will things be back to normal? But it's not the answer we might like to hear.
I want to make it clear, because I think we in past episodes we've gotten away from how to win. Okay, so we have show rules, but those don't really narrow down on how to win today. So I'd like to make it very clear to you two fine gentlemen. If you want to win today, you need to let me know how this is worse than it currently is in real life.
Oh, no. Well, I feel like I would have brought a different book. Oh, no.
That's probably something you should have said out loud. Hey, you know what? Hey, Joe, let's do it. Let's hear about your bad book.
All right. One second.
How bad is it, Joe? How bad is this wonderful world of Shakespeare and music?
Oh, Nick. Nick, my book is kind of hopeful. I think that's the thing at the very heart of it. I don't want to spoil anything. Our theme's a spoiler. Everything's a spoiler. Nick, my book is it's a little bit Yeah, it's a little bit hopeful. It's like, so Station 11 is post-pandemic. It's post-apocalypse. It takes place after 99.9% of the nation has, or I'm sorry, not of the nation, of the world, has been wiped out in mysterious flu. But
who's left?
What's 1%? So like billionaires, the 1%.
Mm-hmm. Ah, the 1% is left.
This is a 1%, like this is a like communist novel, right, Joe?
Is this like that the Truex book? This is like written by the 1%. And like,
love it.
They're supposed to be like the good guys.
I don't get it at all. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yep.
Yep.
Keep going.
All right. It did surprise me though, when they talked in the book about 99.9% of the population, and I was like, man, that's like everybody. So, yeah. Nick, that's still 7 million people.
Okay.
I have kind of a burning question.
Yeah.
Does Donald Trump survive in this book?
Good question.
Great question, Ian.
Donald Trump isn't a character in this book. And in fact,
are there celebrities in your book?
Yeah, there are celebrities in our book. In fact, there's like gossip columns, and one of the celebrities is kind of a main focal point in this book.
So how did everybody die?
Kind of like coronavirus was just like this mutation of this thing that we already had. There was a flu that came up in Georgia, the country, not the state, and it quickly got out of control. It was this mysterious plague. It was called the Georgian flu, and it's tearing through the population. It has an incubation period of hours. It seems to transmit through, I don't know, like eye contact more or less, like basically you have, like, you are exposed to it. You will get the Georgian flu.
Okay, so like awkward people, they were fine.
Yeah, awkward people were fine. It's just the introverts left at Station 11.
I did the math more, and it turns out that the if you had 7,800,000 people left alive, which is 0.1% of the global population, that would be one person to approximately every 6.5 square miles.
Wow. That's like North Dakota.
I don't know what you mean by that's like North Dakota, but I'll take your word for it because you're an expert.
Joe, this book feels a little spot on, a little on the nose here. I feel like you're getting too close to home.
Theme, Nick.
Well, yeah, like it is pandemic week.
Yeah. It is pandemic week. All right. Point for Joe.
All right. I'm going to record my point in my Vince Lombardi column.
Sorry, points. Ian. You shouldn't have helped him out in that past situation.
You're right.
Let's cultivate an atmosphere of not helping each other.
Ooh, good.
Adversarial. This book starts with a guy named Arthur Leander. Arthur Leander is not real, but in the world of Station 11, he's a celebrity. He's a big, big deal. I picture him in my mind as Anthony Hopkins, but I think he must be quite a bit younger than Anthony Hopkins. He's this famous Hollywood actor. He's returning to his roots as he stars in this Broadway adaptation of King Lear. And like when you start this book, you're like, oh, this is definitely going to be the main character of this book. And then he dies of a heart attack on page 7. And you go, oh, so it must not be him. Instead, though, what happens is there's all these people who are in the social orbit of Arthur Leander. There is his ex-wife. There is the little girl who's in the stage production of King Lear with him. There's the guy who gives him CPR on stage and tries to resuscitate him. Those characters in his kind of immediate orbit become the focal point of this book as we move through a pandemic that within about 2 weeks changes the face of the world entirely.
Oh, it happens in 2 weeks?
Yeah, it's super quick. It's like blink of an eye. The world goes from essentially the world that you and I live in, maybe the 2015 world that you and I lived in, to post-apocalyptic.
That seems a little unrealistic, because if there's anything that we've learned over the last year, it's that these things just take forever and they keep getting worse.
Mm. So my thought when I read this at first is they talked about how like crazy communicable this disease is. And they talked about how crazy deadly this disease is. And my first thought was, I don't think it would kill everybody. I feel like it would burn itself out, right? Like, I feel like the logistics didn't make sense. And then I was vindicated because I read an interview with Emily St. John Mandel, and the first thing she said was, yeah, I don't think my disease would actually work that well in the real world. like I feel like it won't actually kill everybody.
I'll buy into the fiction. So everybody's dead. Now what? So that happens pretty quickly, it sounds like, literally, yes. And also in the book. So is it just, are they trying to find their way, Joe? Is this a journey?
So, okay, this is one of the things that
is this a love story?
Did you bring this for Journeys Week by accident?
Or is love this story week?
Is this a story of revenge and Anthony Hopkins is going to come back from the dead to take his revenge?
That Does would be Anthony Bourdain fight Anthony Hopkins? And if so, who wins?
Guys, these are all really good,
related
really
question.
Questions.
If Anthony Bourdain fought Anthony Hopkins, who would win?
Okay, here's a question. Is there anything in this book where you're like, oh, we should have done that in this fiction instead of what we did in our pandemic?
Okay, so it's super hard to say because one of the things that's interesting about this book.
Good question. I don't know.
Well, it is really hard to say because one of the things that's like cool and interesting about this book is we see a lot of the world pre-pandemic. Like this book jumps around in time. So it can be a little disoriented to read. There's a handful of characters that it follows. It jumps around in time. We see a bunch of the world pre-pandemic, like barely pre-pandemic. We see a bunch of the world like decently pre-pandemic, maybe like 10 years before the pandemic. And then we see a bunch of the world like 20 years post-pandemic. So we don't really see a lot of like year one, year two, year five.
Okay.
So
I'm assuming
like,
this follows characters then?
Yeah. So it's like character point of view chapters. Like I said, some pre-pandemic, some post-pandemic.
Yeah. But like, do you see the same characters over that time span?
Yeah, so all those people that kind of witnessed Arthur Leander die and a few
King Lear,
other characters,
yeah.
Yep, that witnessed King Lear die, each of them becomes a point of view character that you follow. One of the cool things about setting so much of this in 20 years post-pandemic is I feel like most apocalypse books that I've read in the past, and I kept thinking about The Road as I read this, they seem like they're relatively quickly post-pandemic, like post-apocalypse, within a few years, right? Like the world is still tough. People are scrambling for position. 20 years later, the world is kind of calmed down. Like it's settled into its rhythms. The people who are going to die have died. The people who are alive have figured out ways to live, whether that's like farming or hunting or like living in these small communities or whatever the case is. So it's really kind of this like relaxed look at a post-pandemic world.
Hmm. So chill down. Get a margarita.
Mm-hmm. Jimmy Buffett is one of the celebrities in this movie.
In the book? Are you serious?
No, I'm not.
Oh. That would have made it immediately cooler.
The main settlement is called Margaritaville. It is a bar in Tallahassee.
I want to read that book now. Is there any way we can put a little bit of just a small pandemic in Too Many Butlers?
Oh. Maybe like somebody has the sniffles like that.
But like,
and then
it
he
turns
gives
out,
it to somebody
I don't know, maybe
else.
It turns out not to be a pandemic because that's not really the vibe we're going for. It would be really cool if
maybe
if there were.
Maybe that's how we find the killer because they also have the sniffles. And it's like, oh, they were in like the last thing we saw with Billy Bob was that he had the sniffles. And also the butler had the sniffles.
Yep.
And that's, that's great. But it could be like super subtle. So you only put it together at the very end. Like that it's revealed on the last page.
Joe, this book doesn't really sound that interesting. Is there anything interesting you'd like to share with me? It sounds like a lot of people die and it just we cover some different time frames. Is there anything interesting in this book that happens?
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff. Nick, there is a cult in this book with an evil leader who like hunts some of the main characters. That sounds pretty cool, doesn't it?
It sounds kind of like The Stand. Keep going.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it sounds kind of like The Stand.
Okay. All right. Well, hey, which one came out first?
Let me go to the...
Oh, this notes. Is a recent book. Definitely The Stand. Are there any, is there like a bomb?
Like this week's atom episode bomb? Brought to you by The Stand, a limited series recently completed on CBS All Access. Watch The Stand wherever you get your TV. Definitely, they are our sponsors.
Mm-hmm. Only on the Peacock Network.
Okay, is there a bomb? There is not a bomb. We're kind of post bombs in this world.
Okay, all right. And then, so what happens? What is the journey that they have to go across the country on a road?
So, boy, what happens in this book?
Oh, no. Would you say there's, hey, Joe, let me help you out here. Would you say there's personal growth?
Yeah, there's. It's mostly personal growth. It's all personal growth.
Well, don't say it like that.
No, it's. Well, no,
he
it
should.
Is.
He should.
That
say
matters,
it like that.
But that's not like fun and exciting. Okay, this is the cool part about this book, Nick. It is. These are the things I liked. A, it's not like other post-apocalyptic books.
Okay. Right?
Like it, cool. It's got this pretty hopeful tone. It has no bombs. It has very little plot. No, I shouldn't say it has little plot, but like they're not like driving to restore civilization, right? Like that's never like civilization is this thing of the past. There's this museum where they collect these like weird little artifacts from civilization, like artifacts that people remember, like, you know, iPhones and stuff
like a toaster.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah, like toasters. Good example.
Is there electricity in the future?
Good question. There is basically not electricity. Yeah, there's basically not electricity.
Sounds like that's another thing we could be grateful for then.
But they do collect copies of this book called Station 11. Station 11 is a comic book written by one of the main characters, and it's kind of like this, almost like this, like, I don't want to say Bible, but it really does have like this almost like
Bible. Yeah.
No, it does have like this religious devotion to some of the characters in this book.
What is Station 11, Joe?
Oh boy. So Station 11 is fictional, even in this world of fiction. Station 11 is the world of this comic book that one of the characters drew in the pre-pandemic world. It is a space station that has malfunctioned and has totally flooded. And people in the space station live on these little islands, which is kind of a metaphor for the world that people in post-pandemic world are living in now. Like everybody's on this island and the spot between the islands are like these unknown things. When I say islands, Nick, I'm very afraid that you're picturing actual islands. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about what like other little pods of humanity separated by vast stretches of nothing.
Hey, so Ian, do you think your book is going to be better sounding than this?
I definitely do. I'm compiling a list of differences.
Okay, good. Joe, did you like this book?
Yeah, I dug it. I thought it was
really
cool.
That's a really good question.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool. There were times that it was like up and down for me. It took me a while to figure out like what the book was. I don't know if I want to say what it was doing or what it was about, but like for the most part, you're like hanging out with these characters. And sometimes it's before the pandemic. Sometimes it's after the pandemic. But I think she does interesting things. So for example, one of the characters is a member of this traveling symphony, and it's literally a traveling group of minstrels in this post-pandemic world that goes around. It is filled with musicians. It is filled with actors, and they travel from settlement to settlement and they perform. And this in the post-pandemic world is seen as this really valuable thing that these people put on.
I say this as someone who, loves theater and also incidentally music, someone who loves theater so much that he got his PhD in it. But like this seems like an interesting priority in the post-apocalypse to say, forget electricity. We're going to keep Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah. Well, and that's when I say this isn't like other pandemic books. I feel like when you look at other post-apocalyptic books, it's all about like, we're going to go back to science and we're going to restore technology and we're going to rebuild society. But one of the things that's awesome here is like, they take time to have this symphony. They take time to have this, like, this comic book. There's a museum that a guy curates. Another guy like has a newspaper. Another guy like has a library. And it's these things that are seen as important enough 20 years later to be foundational to society. There's no electricity, right? Like people are, they have crossbows, you know, or candles or knives, right? But like they care about libraries and museums and symphonies and Shakespeare.
Do you think I'm going to go out on a limb here and mm-hmm. guess that Emily St. John Mandel likes reading and books and fine art and stuff.
Decent guess.
Do you think this is the post-apocalypse that she wants? Like, is she writing this into, like, is this, not to say wishful thinking, I like I say, that stuff is cool, but is she saying, is she imagining a world which would just value non-essential, non-survival things like symphonies and newspapers and museums?
So, okay, imagine all this stuff goes away, right? And imagine we still...
Hold on. Let me try really hard.
Yep, try to imagine. Nick, are you imagining? Can you see it?
This is tough.
Would it help you imagine if a bunch of celebrities edited together a video of them singing Imagine 2 weeks into a pandemic?
Nick, would that help?
Please answer the question, Nick.
It might. Do you have anything I can watch?
Good news.
We're post-pandemic at this point, and they're in a world in which basically like the conveniences of modern society aren't coming back. Like nobody here is saying like, well, we're going to get back, you know, iPhones. We're going to get back the internet. Like that's never a discussion.
They're like the worst.
When you read it and you see this world without all of these modern conveniences and instead with like these people spending time together in these small communities and traveling together, like even
secret
though,
utopia, secret even utopia.
Though, yeah. Even though the world is like kind of dangerous and like kind of scary and kind of unknown in most ways, it's a secret utopia. Oh. It's really hard to read this book and not think at times like, man, that sounds really nice. Like it'd be nice to be one of the last 7 million people on this planet.
Are you saying, is this book saying that maybe
we need a good pandemic?
The pandemic wasn't such a bad idea after all.
Oh, no.
Like, there's a dreadful moment in my book, not to get too far ahead of us here, but there's a dreadful moment in my book where, like, there are people holed up together in this pretty, like, good setup to, away from the zombies, and one guy decides that the pandemic is actually a good cleansing thing that's changing mm-hmm. the world for the better. So he goes upstairs and lets all the zombies in.
Yeah, so I'm just filling out my bingo card here. I also have a guy who believes it's like a cleansing thing on mine. We should have done a bingo card for this game. So is she saying it's better? I don't think she's necessarily it's better. I think she's saying like, look, there'd be some pros.
Why did that 1% live?
So it's actually never specified. Like at first,
lazy writing. It's just too cool. We just move right past it.
Well, the prophet is like, well, you lived because you guys aren't sinners. Like this super dude, like yeah, bad dude course, prophet. Yeah. Like you guys aren't sinners. It's like other they people are say. Like, oh well, we just didn't get the Georgian flu. But I don't know. It seems like everybody got the Georgian flu. I think they just had some sort of resistance to it.
See, I think we talked about this in previous episodes, but I appreciate the fake science in the books, the fake explanation. Yeah.
Okay, but here's, okay, I hear what you're saying, Nick, but here's the counterpoint. They have to decide what to include, what parts of the tropes to include and what not. And I think the classic one, yeah. like, oh, is there a secret resistance? Like what's the word?
Resistance.
Immunity. Do people mm-hmm. have secret immunity to it? Like that's one that authors have to choose, am I going to include it or am I not?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, well, include it because you're writing a book about pandemic. All right,
Nick?
Guess what?
Nick,
don't write the book then. I want the information. I want to know what the fuck happened.
Nick would like a scientific tome on how to survive a pandemic.
Yeah, this 1% accidentally rubbed against a rock and it was mm-hmm. a special rock.
A magic rock.
It was a magic rock.
Which is why, Nick, you need to go yes. rub yourself against some rocks.
Yes, mm-hmm. roll around in the dirt. I think, all right. Nah.
Well, I thought it was pretty good. Hey, listener right. Olivia, I thought it was a good book. Thank you for the recommendation.
What did Olivia say about this book?
Olivia says, this book is about a global pandemic, and we are currently... in a global pandemic. Okay, so that's not why it's great, but given the circumstances of our world right now, the story's really compelling. The novel moves back and forth through time, chronicling the inception of the pandemic, the present of the pandemic, and the time in between when people had to relearn their ways of life. Four of the main characters have connections to the fifth one, and as the story unfolds, connections between the characters are revealed. Honestly, it's like a super intricate book due to the jumping around in POV. It shifts hard to describe, but maybe that's why it's great after all. I know I really enjoyed it. Hey, listener Olivia, thank you. You've done a better job describing that than I have. I also really enjoyed it.
Hey, listen, guys, this episode is kind of far-flung, highfalutin. I'm jonesing for something a little more realistic, grounded. What do you think?
A little more down to earth.
Down to earth. Down to earth.
Something about like geology or something.
Yeah, dirt. Stories about dirt.
Right.
Dirt stories.
Stories about dirt. I do feel like my book was kind of this hopeful look at humanity. I'd like to read a book next week that's like the worst that humanity has to offer. Or that sounds like more in line with our themes.
So are you thinking nonfiction, Ian?
Yeah, probably nonfiction, probably truthful of some way.
Any magic?
Magic. I don't want any magic.
What about magical realism, Ian?
No.
Can we do magical realism?
Joe? That's a nice compromise, Ian. Maybe we could bring books about true things.
Let's bring true crime books next week. I'm going to bring Michelle McNamara's posthumously published book, I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which is about the Golden State Killer and also Michelle McNamara herself. And it just so happens that it helped them catch the Golden State Killer, which I think is a pretty interesting juxtaposition of truth and crime. Justice. It's justice. It's not such a downer.
It helped him catch him. That's amazing.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Nick, I have maybe the novel that started it all, the novel that kicked off the true crime craze that we are all living in today. It's
every
like
day.
All my wife watches is true crime documentaries on Netflix. I'm of course talking about In Cold Blood. Yeah. Cut out anything I say about my wife, please. I'm of course talking about In Cold Blood, the 1966 novel by Truman Capote, probably his most famous book.
In his name.
Yeah, it's right in his name. True
Destiny.
Man Capote.
I'm just going to go ahead and say there is a good bit of difference between my book and Joe's book. Now, there are some similarities. I would say the similarity of jumping around is a similarity. And I really wonder if that's
in
just
time or...
Yeah,
or like at the third quarter of a Badgers game, like when you jump
like
around.
Get out your seat and jump around. No, definitely flashbacks, lots and lots of flashbacks. People telling each other stories like, "Oh, where'd you come from? How did you get here?" These kinds of things. I kind of wonder if that's just a trope of like post-apocalypse fiction. This need to flashback to the night it happened, the day when the earth stood still, all this kind of stuff. But
yeah, well, that's an interesting day. That's like the day.
Yeah,
it's day zero.
You want to hear about it's the most interesting part of the story.
Yeah, so it's probably good for the author to include that. The fulcrum
in my book, it's like when the interesting stuff starts. There is definitely a plot in this book. There are definitely bombs and there are definitely zombies. And there's not so much an interest on I feel terrible saying it, but like the unnecessary stuff of life. And there's much more of an insistence on like, how do we eat?
Dr. Ian DeYoung, if I can interrupt just for a second, you have your PhD in Shakespeare. Now are talking about the unnecessary stuff in life. Can we just get you on the record, maybe with a few examples of what that unnecessary stuff is?
I would say, in a pandemic, I'm going
podcasts.
First for things like food and water, and less for things like is my collection of John Coltrane records complete.
Mint condition action figures.
Right.
Like in Joe's book.
I think that things like Shakespeare matter a lot, but if I have to choose between Shakespeare and living, I'm going to choose living 100 times out of 100.
What about food, Ian?
Yeah, food. Food is good. I like food.
Food.
Sure, but what if you had to sacrifice like some food or some living to preserve Shakespeare? Like, let your time be set.
I don't know if, some living is a possibility, like a gradient. Either I'm like alive or I'm not.
Well, I mean, post-pandemic, I think we're all going to sacrifice some living. I don't think we're all going to die at 95 years old in the nursing home.
Big living, like Joe's 1%.
The 1%. This book, so my book, Zone 1, Colson Whitehead, he did not win a Pulitzer for it. Sorry. Sorry if you were hoping for that. That's a mark, black mark against it. But it's a really good book. It is, it's really, so I'm going to start by talking about kind of, it's kind of having a foot in two worlds. So, Glenn Duncan reviewed Zone One for the New York Times back when it came out, and he compared it to an intellectual dating a porn star. These are his words. So Colson Whitehead is this two-time Pulitzer Prize winning MacArthur Genius Grant scoring high concept literary novelist. Like, he writes literature. That's kind of like his thing. And he's writing a horror book. Like, this is just zombie. It's like,
this is like genre. This is like cheap.
It's a genre. Right?
Like, this is like, this is pulp.
It's really interesting that this book kind of, it does that sort of literary thing where it makes reflections about, you know, consumer culture and what people value and what it takes to stay alive. But it's also got like headshots and, you know, scavenging and all, basically all the stuff that you've come to know and love from the Fallout games.
Right.
And it's really fascinating. And
upgradable armor.
Upgradable armor.
Yes, actually the armor is part of this.
Oh my God.
It turns out, like, one of the first, this is, there's a kind of, this book is kind of like darkly ironic. It turns out one of the first things that they invented after after what they call last night capitalized last night.
Cool.
That's the zero day when everything goes
final night.
Right. So it turns out that one of the first things that they invented and one of the only things they've really invented post apocalypse is bite proof armor. Which they
do we not currently have bite proof armor? Because I would
cloth that you can cover your whole body with. They call it mesh. It's like basically a ripoff. In the novel, somebody just like reverse engineered Kevlar.
Oh, like what you wear on it for sharks.
Yeah, it's mithril. It's modern day mithril.
Yes. Yes, but this is the first, like, this is the first one of two things. They invented two things after the apocalypse: bite-proof armor that could go, like, clothing that could go all over you, and incinerators to destroy the bodies of the dead.
Oh, that's good. I feel like they didn't invent either of those things. Like they kind of scavenged or salvaged the idea.
Let it go, Joe.
Produced them at a massive scale.
Like, goddamn armor.
But this is like, this
Joe,
is...
Joe, this is a fiction book. It's fiction.
Yes. Fiction.
Fiction. All right.
Fiction story. Not real.
Okay. Sorry, we should have asked that earlier. Joe was thinking this was a nonfiction. But
I'm
we
just
didn't
salty
clarify
because
it, so.
I feel like I'm just, I have no chance of winning this week. I'm just like, I just want to play the spoiler, guys. I'm just going to
be
throwing bombs.
Joe's going to be sniping from the gutters the
whole
time.
That's it.
You never know, Joe. You never know. He could really biff this. Ian.
Yeah.
We cut you off with some shenaniganery.
Oh,
please, as you were.
Let me just tell you what this book is about. And I want to read another quote from this New York Times review, and then I'll stop because I'm not just going to read this out loud. It's well put, which is why I'm saying it. I'm reading it. This is from Glenn Duncan's New York Times review. He says, "This is a love story, more specifically, a story of lost love. At first glance, contemporary America's lost love for its own cultural protocols from sidewalk etiquette to sitcom vectors. But beyond that, humanity's love for ritual, its dependence on ways of imposing meaning on the void, for religious trinkets or scientific models or personal superstitions or long-term financial plans. For every gimmick, brand, preference, boxed, set, or mumbled prayer that helps us deny the absurdity of our predicament and the certainty of death." So this is a love story to the way things were. And it's not really a spoiler to say it's you don't get back there. You can't go home.
Yeah, I think we kind of knew that. Are there any pandemic books where you do?
It's like, guys, then everything was fine. And like we figured it out. We got electricity again. Everything was fine.
Yes, yes, yes. Actually, I was running through them in my mind, the Rolodex. There's a book which I'll bring to the podcast at some future date. It's an amazing book. Inspiration for 28 Days Later. It's called Day of the Triffids. It was published in the 50s. And it has talking plants and the possibility that we will rebuild.
Feed me, Seymour.
Feed me.
It doesn't say feed me, Seymour. No, they. Well, I'm not going to get into it. It's a great book. I want to bring it to the podcast. Let's make it a reason for me to bring that to the podcast.
All right. This is what I hate about every pandemic. And let's just stop using that word. Apocalyptic.
Yeah, right,
this is what I hate. Book. This is what I hate about every post-apocalyptic
talk
movie.
Go ahead.
Book, story. There are two types of people.
Okay.
Either highly intelligent and can always get their way out of a situation, or just absolute morons. And then, like, don't get me wrong, there are the people in between. But the people who the story pivots on. Are those two types of people. And everybody else is just, they're dog food. They are just in the way to die or not die or whatever.
Yep. Mm. Oh, so man, Nick, does that happen here? I'm so happy you said that because this is one of my reasons you should read this book. This book is worth reading because of the main character. His nickname, we never learned his real name. His real name is Mark, or his nickname is Mark Spitz.
Let's just call him Nick.
Wait, that's his nickname is Mark Spitz?
Yes.
Is it because he spit on somebody?
No.
I thought his nickname would be like daggers or like snake eyes.
No, he's named after the record-setting Olympic swimmer. There's a whole like backstory for it, which isn't really important. But the point is, Mark Spitz, our main character, is not superhuman. He's not a well-trained loner. He's not an idiot kind of bumbling around. He is
Dude, should I hit this red button?
Sorry, what's
self-described.
That?
I was just making a joke about the idiot hitting a red button.
Nick, do you have something to share with the class? That was Ian's, do you have something to share with the class tone?
Picked up on it and I doubled down and explained the joke anyway.
Love it. Okay, so our main character is not some kind of like highly trained, basically Batman without the suit. Mm-hmm. He is a B student. Like, calls himself a human cockroach because he always manages to kind of like just avoid the problems. Not so much because he's so good at avoiding them, but just it doesn't quite happen to him. So he slides through life on this mediocrity. He's like, kind of he actually talks about when I was little, like I wanted to be the Frodo Baggins, you know, throwing the ring in the fire, or the Harry Potter defeating Voldemort or whatever. Like he wanted to be the superhero, and he found out he wasn't, and somehow he just survives through
it all. Works out
much. Yeah. Oh, but it's not like he's an idiot though. He's not like some loser who keeps like just barely like, kind of bumbling through life and everything is happening all around him. And he's just kind of like galumphing along like a moron. He's competent. Like he hides his go pack. He has a gun and he knows how to use it. He's like aware. He makes little mistakes here and there, but the mistakes never really quite catch up with him. And so he's kind of this everyman. Like, I know
is
what you're
he
saying.
Is he an average Joe or is he a schmuck?
Is he an average Joe or is he a schmo?
Is he an average Joe or is he an average schmo?
I think he's an average Joe schmo. That's Joe actually schmo. What I have.
Mm-hmm. This is a hopeful message for so many of our students, Ian. Like, I think so many of our students sit in their classrooms and they look around and they say like, wow, there's so many students in this classroom who are like, so much more impressive than me in every single way. But what they need to know is, hey, when the apocalypse happens, You might
survive.
Bumble along.
He's got the book has all these characters who are kind of like these. He's got these excellent A students. He's got the ones who are kind of, they should excel. And
but they draw attention to themselves, don't they?
They just don't make it. That's kind of a cool thing.
We get it.
For a genre novel like this to say, hey, our main character is kind of an average guy and we want to be like him. We identify with him. That's crazy. And it's cool. Like, he has no superpowers. He's just kind of scraping by.
But isn't that like the thing about zombie fiction? Like, I'm going to go, you have zombies in this book. Yeah. Like, you talked
about
fight
proof.
Yes, I do.
I have two kinds of zombies, as a matter of fact.
Wow. Amazing.
Good job, Ian.
But like, isn't that like
future reference, but
isn't that like the pornography of zombie books is like, hey, I'm just this dude in my real life. Like, I'm fine. I'm skating by. But guess what?
Mm-hmm.
When there's zombies like that are, Ian, do you have slow zombies? Do you have fast zombies? Do you have like smart zombies?
They're fast zombies.
Yeah, like it's like, but hey, when zombies are here, like I can outmatch hordes of mindless creatures.
No,
like,
isn't I don't that think like that's zombie? No, that's not what Ian's saying. He doesn't outmatch him though.
I'm not saying that's what Ian's saying. I'm saying that's like a zombie fiction thing.
I would say yes. Yes.
Like, I think, yeah, no, I would agree. I don't think this concept is that original, Ian, but I get it. It's cool. I'll buy it.
It's fine. Ian, it's fine.
Yeah, we're not asking for originality here. We're asking for good. So
I am going to go ahead and try and die on this hill. I would argue that this is original. this isn't some rando who ends up kind of being the hero of the post-apocalyptic world. He's just another foot soldier in the post-apocalyptic world who manages to survive. He's not going out there and doing like dramatic, like mowing down the zombies, you know, the montage where he saves everyone by himself. He barely makes it out. Over and over, like he's not the action movie hero here.
So you said this is like a love letter for the way life used to be.
Yes.
Do I have to ask you about that?
No, you don't. You don't want to. That's fine.
I think. I mean, is there anything else to say there, or that's, you know? I think I get it, right? Or, like, is there an example?
Well, so that what he's doing is he's clearing, he and a group of a bunch of other people are clearing New York City. And the goal is to try and resettle New York City.
Clearing what?
Like clearing.
So like
corpses? What does that mean?
Well, so after the apocalypse, there are two kinds of zombies. There are the Skells, who are your classic fast zombies. And there are stragglers. Stragglers are the vast majority of the infected. They don't like want human flesh. They just...
Oh.
They go back to a place that was meaningful to them, and they stand there, or they sit there.
Jesus, that's horrifying.
It's pretty creepy, and this is another place
that is actually, I think, the most original, brilliant thing you've said.
Right. Yeah. So
that's an incredible type of zombie.
Like, this is my addition to the. So you've got your classic, like, whatever, Skells. Yeah, you shoot them in the head, whatever. But these stragglers and. And he kind of takes time to like show you how various people interact with the stragglers. Some of them like mercy kill, put them down fast. Other folks like kind of play around with them, torture them, or like, you know, make funny, like do photo ops with them, like Abu Ghraib.
It's a metaphor.
Terrifying Abu Ghraib.
It's a metaphor. We found the metaphor.
Some of them.
Do stragglers bite?
Well, I'm not going to spoil that, but.
Okay. So yeah. All right.
some people like play a game called guess the straggler. Basically, like, why are they
around
here?
The rosy?
This is kind of one of the questions.
Why are they here?
The novel asks, like, because we keep running across these stragglers. Why is this one standing?
Are they
right
the
here?
Real? Are they the average Joe incarnate?
I don't know what you mean by that, but no. I'm pretty sure the answer is no. The point is like these stragglers are just they're everywhere, and you don't know where they're going to be. So these teams of civilian, like, these are not the Marines. The Marines have already come through and killed all the fast zombies, or most of them. The sweepers, like our main character Mark Spitz and his team, they have to go floor by floor, building by building, block by block through New York City and find and kill all of the stragglers.
Oh, man.
And so this is like, it's kind of, he compares it to a 9-to-5 job. They clock in and they clock out.
It's a hard to make a living.
I don't know if we have the rights to that, Nick. I think you have to stop singing it.
It's fair use. It's parody. Counts as parody.
Come at me, Dolly. That's all
so,
good.
So, like, this gives us kind of a spectrum, and it also allows us to draw a comparison between human beings who are violent and fast and going around hungering for destruction, and the human beings who are more, I don't know, just returning to the place that was familiar to them.
Yeah, so this is, oh, so who's the real zombie?
Well, it is the zombies. The zombies are still the real zombies. But this is one of the things that the book does, is it kind of like says, hey, those stragglers that are so creepy, it's kind of like that's what people do in their 9-to-5 jobs. Yeah, and it's kind of like even after the apocalypse, this is where we still...
So it's commentary on the saps of the world.
Sort of. These
drones.
Yeah,
it is. But also let me emphasize, like, it's also like really good horror. So I don't want to go too far in it's like literary. It is literary, but also like Colson Whitehead really doesn't like doing the same thing over and over. And so when he like started out writing this book, he has a background just loving horror stories, horror books, horror fiction, movies in general.
That's great.
He's like, I wanted to do that. And so he did. Yeah. And that's why he put fast zombies in, because that's pretty scary. And like,
because I want to write about fast zombies. Fuck it.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, and he got this MacArthur Genius Grant, which gives him the opportunity to just like have, you know,
wait, that was that the, like the kind of funding for this period in his life that he's like, yeah, I'm going to write this book now. Because that's a great use of that money.
It's a good use of that money. It kind of
lied
to
me. Tell me that that's what his choice was.
I'm going to write a zombie book. You think I'm a genius? I'm going to write about running this.
Genre.
Yes, yes. This is one of the things he did with his MacArthur money. He wrote a book about zombies. Because like, so he says he's a misanthrope. He's like, I don't like people. People are the worst. They're dumb. Mm. They're gross. And so he says zombie fiction allows him to kind of like indulge that.
By eating them. Anything else you want to tell us about this? Did you like the book?
I love the book. The three reasons you should read this book. Our main character, who is an average guy.
Reason number one.
Average guy, main character. Number two, yeah. Stragglers. Number three, the end. So... I'm not going to spoil it. Don't worry.
Are you about to tell us? Sounds like really
going to spoil it. But Ian's about to hit the eight ball in the corner pocket right now. Like Ian's about to scratch on the eight ball.
Fingers crossed, Joe.
All right, I'm ready.
So there are a lot of people who say this book takes a while to get going. This may be true, but after a while, probably after a different point for everybody, this turns into this really mesmerizing story about people who aren't particularly heroic, and the world is not like a great, cool, like fun post-apocalyptic world, unlike Joe's book, but they're survivors. It's not like no one likes this new state of affairs, but it's better than nothing. And as readers, we end up rooting for kind of order and civilization, not because it's an awesome order, but because it's better than the alternative. And the way this book ramps up, like throwing in little clues toward the end, it's just so, so good. I was reading outside and I was getting sunburned, and I knew I was getting sunburned, and I didn't care. I was like, I will take the sunburn because I can't put this book down. Like, I was just like, I was hooked. Yeah. And it kind of paid it off. Like, it really did. It really did pay it off.
Joe, did you get sunburned for your book?
I can't believe that Ian lives somewhere where you can currently get sunburned. It's
I was
like
in California.
Yeah, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, that almost, that's maybe a negative point for Ian.
Yeah, oh, no. Sorry, Ian.
Feel bad. Joe, you lose.
Yeah, whatever. I don't have a quote anyway, dickhead.
I'm going to bleep that out. Ian.
Yep.
Please. Read us, before you read us a quote, Litheads, if you'd like to recommend a book.
Like Olivia did this week.
Like Olivia did. This is not... See,
yeah, don't be mean to Olivia.
It kind of made it sound like we punished Olivia, but that wasn't Olivia's fault. That was Joe's fault. So I just want to be clear. Litheads, if you submit a book or a theme for us to do on our show, we won't be that hard on you.
We'll give it a fair shot.
On Joe or Ian.
Not like you were mean to Olivia just now. Olivia, I've let you down. I'd like to, before Ian reads his quote, I would like to issue a personal apologies to loyal Lithead Olivia. Olivia, I thought Station 11 was great. I think these guys are weirdos. I think they don't understand, like, they don't live in a
beautiful
world.
I think we should make the loser apologize every week.
I'm apologizing only to Olivia. I do not apologize to Nick.
Time.
Ian, anyway, Ian, would you like to do the thing?
I'd love to do the thing. So this is one of the many flashbacks in this book. We get to a lot of windows on our main character's Mark Spitz's life before last night, which is what they call the zero day. And in one of these, we get the following insight on Mark's relationship with his father. When Mark Spitz was a child, his father had shared his favorite nuclear war movies with him. Father-son bonding on overcast afternoons, fresh-faced rising stars who never made it big, and crag-faced character actors marching through the acid rain narratives and ash-smeared landscapes, soldiering on, slapping hysterical comrades across the face. Get a grip on yourself! We're going to make it! Dropping one by one as they chased the rumors of sanctuary. He asked, "What does apocalypse mean, Daddy?" And his father pressed pause and told him, "It means that in the future, things will be even worse than they are